I'm Christian Corley, and I'm joined with, I'm not joined with anyone, apart from my wife, but that's another story. I'm joined by James McLean.
Hello.
In a completely different way, over a Skype telephone line. Hello, James, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good, I'm glad about that, after that introduction. we're convening here for a particular purpose. Although I do, I was minded of the fact that I bought the Doctor Who magazine 40th anniversary edition, which is the first time I've bought Doctor Who magazine in a few years now, and I still haven't read it, despite the fact that I will probably enjoy everything that's in it. I just haven't got around to reading it, and this set me upon a longer kind of look at things that I've got to read that I haven't yet read. So I've got books on writing comedy. I have two of the Midsummer Murders original books still to read. I have two issues of Blocks magazine, which is a really cool Lego magazine, which I don't know if you're a big, if anyone out there's a fan of Lego, check out Blocks. They sell it in W.H. Smith. Really good read. Well, I mean, I say that. I've got like halfway through both of them. And I've also got this, you remember Zap magazine?
Yep.
I've got a special edition of that, which has been compiled as a crowdfunder. In annual form, which I've basically stared at and stroked, but haven't actually read yet. And I'm thinking, am I running out of time to read things?
Saturation.
Yeah. Everything's saturated, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's too much of everything.
No, can't disagree with you there. I find that, yes, it becomes a stress.
Now, a few years ago, 2009, there were no episodes of Doctor Who apart from those three specials. And everyone was like, whoa, what? What's he playing at? No Doctor Who. And then a few years after that, in 2014, 15, around that sort of time, there was obviously the split season in 2013. And then there was that year with no Doctor Who. And everyone's going, oh, my God, no Doctor Who. And then we're just coming towards the end of a year with no Doctor Who. And everyone's like, oh, sorry. And I'm wondering whether, is this an age thing where I'm thinking, well, you know, it's not on. There's other stuff to watch. It probably needs a bit of a breather anyway. Or, you know, is that an age thing? Or are young people thinking, oh, my God, there's no Doctor Who. What the hell am I going to do? I'll have to buy some Big Finish or something. Or is it, you know, or is this more like a cultural thing where there's no Doctor Who, whatever? Because I'm thinking of things like Ripper Street, which took a year or two off, and that's after it had moved to Amazon, and Man in the High Castle, another Amazon series, which took either a year or 18 months off between series two and series three. Now in that case, I've kind of like lost the thread, so I'm gonna have to go back. And they actually produced a special episode at the beginning of series three for you to catch up on series one and two, because it was so long before. And I'm wondering whether this is now kind of, I mean, do you think this just, is this now like baked into shows now where they take a long break?
Yeah, probably. I mean, well, yeah. I mean, if you've got a saturation of content again, I suspect that will affect, you know, when shows are needed as well, when they need to be commissioned.
Mm.
I think certainly from an audience point of view, you get less of that clamour, because back in 2011, even 2012, like we said last time, there was no original online content in the same capacity as there is now. So again, that massively changes how we consume. So that's going to be a big issue that's going to factor into how people need a new series of anything. How that works in terms of production, I think, can be difficult, and it can be political, as we know. But I certainly haven't had that for years. But I think probably one of the reasons there isn't this sort of clamour anymore is because, as you say, and as you were saying, you know, the amount of content you've got to read, you just don't need it, do you?
No. Well, it's not just reading, Anne. I mean, it's gaming as well. I know,
yeah,
gaming isn't for everyone, but on the other hand, you know, it's an industry that's bigger than the movie industry. And I've mentioned this before on the podcast with a K. I'm still playing Red Dead Redemption 2. Partly because of my workload. Also partly because I like to just spend a lot of time in the game because it's such an amazing world that they've created in there. And the voice acting is second to none. And visually, it's a superb game. But I've been playing it for over a year now. And that's kind of got me thinking about things like this single thing with the games and the movie industry and publishing and TV. And, back in the day, we had like 20 million people turning in to watch, someone get married on Coronation Street. And you don't get figures like that anymore. And yet there's clearly even a bigger audience out there now. And yet it's very difficult to find figures for who's watching what on like Netflix or Amazon or whatever. Which makes me wonder who's actually... are the subscribers actually paying for those programs or are advertisers paying for those programs? Because there isn't any advertising from what I can tell.
That's why they can keep it a sort of gated information that you know is all embedded within their between sort of shareholders themselves. You don't have to just sort of be releasing information on what the figures are unless you want to. And Netflix has recently gone through a policy of now releasing information on clickage, I guess, but how that's correlated, I don't know. I don't know. I suspect anyone outside of Netflix can really find out how that is sort of those statistics are drawn up, or whether those statistics are then massaged, because it's a private company. It's not part of any sort of regulatory service either, which means it stands aside from having to actually show anything really at all. So it makes it very difficult to tell how they're. But I think in a sense that, not wanting to sound sort of neoliberal in any way, I suppose for television though, that kind of all sort of kind of benefits it, in the sense that you look at the BBC and because of neoliberalism, the BBC has sort of been pressured into considering what shows are viable due to ratings. Mm-hmm. And in the end, what is viable, what should be broadcast, and the benefits of what is broadcast or what is distributed doesn't necessarily have to be about popularity. You can have some shows for selling a subscription service, which can be a loss leader if they get people to buy into that subscription service and stay, and then consume other shows. That show might not in itself, the costs of running it might not necessarily have to be as important to how many stay and watch it to how many stay and subscribe to watch everything else. So it becomes a more complex market than what is popular in itself. And I think that again is something which TV has always struggled with, isn't it? Is this sort of like, how do we justify what is on, what should be shown and what shouldn't be? And getting away from that whole thing of popularity is probably in a sense a good thing, but what Netflix is actually basing it on, I have no idea. It might be sort of, who knows, I suppose is the thing. And I know that's always been a frustration for those sort of more traditional broadcasting companies, are these sort of private, narrow casting digital libraries, which don't really have a fixed abode, can do whatever they want, and they don't have that same sort of pressure. And I think that is always deeply frustrating. It's like, how many people are watching Stranger Things? Show us, prove it to us. And they're kind of like, well, we don't have to. Why should we? We don't even have any market sponsors. We don't have any advertisers, as you say. We don't have to deal with them, because obviously ratings initially, especially for commercial television, was about sponsorship. It's about showing what the viewing figures are to sort of be able to make specific deals with advertisers at certain premium levels. As soon as you don't have that, you don't have to give out how popular something is, especially if that's not necessarily how your commercial strategy operates. But for the consumer, it's very weird and sometimes disappointing, because you can't really tell how good something's going. I liked Gourmet Samurai on Netflix, and I don't think it's got a second season. And I was always looking and I was wondering and just seeing how many times it comes into my feed, thinking, oh, perhaps it's popular, but you're aware that that's your bubble, that's your algorithmic bubble that is sort of feeding that to show. This is what's popular on Netflix at the moment. Yeah, strange. If I turn over to someone else on my account subscription, I don't see it at all because they don't watch those kind of shows. So, yeah, all very weird.
Yeah, absolutely. I do, and I mean, if you're wondering why we're actually talking about this particular angle on things, it's because, you know, sooner or later, it seems to me, the Doctor Who has got to kind of move away from just being like a exclusive BBC show. In which case, all these things are going to come into play. And whether or not that's because BBC shifts it over to BBC Studios and they push it out through BritBox or some other service they co-produce with or whatever, these things are going to matter. So it is interesting to kind of like batten down, well, bat these things down into some sort of understandable shape and what the context might be for Doctor Who or any other, you know, any other British show that might take off in the meantime that has a kind of cult following. I mean, have you ever watched The Crown?
No, I know of it, never watched.
Yeah,
it.
I'm the same. I know that's a online show, isn't it?
Mm.
I've never watched it. I know my parents watch it. I think it's pretty much the only thing that they watch on Amazon. But the same thing must come in with that. And, you know, that's a huge show, which I think a lot of people don't realize that that's just like an Amazon-only show. That's not like an online-only show. It's not like a network show. I only found out myself a few months ago. I assumed it was on TV because obviously ITV did that Victoria show with Jenna Coleman. And yeah. Obviously not the same thing, different king, different queen, but, you know, same kind of idea of a biopic of a member of a reigning monarch. It's strange. If we went back to like when Brian and I started the podcast with the K in 2007, or when James helped me to launch into something listenable in 2011, very different landscape of television.
Yeah.
So remarkably different. We wouldn't have gone near having a conversation like this because we would have been in the realms of science fiction in some ways.
No, definitely. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, the whole subscription model just didn't exist, not in the way that it is now, and certainly to the amount of content. But yeah, it's insane. I say it's insane because, you know, again, it's the question of, like, you know, how well do current DVDs of Doctor Who sell? And you're kind of like, well, a lot of people sort of age which the new Doctor Who is probably targeting don't buy DVDs anymore. The classic DVDs will sell because A, they're not on television in the same sort of saturation as you'll find the new show on iPlayer. And, you know, that's a different mindset, people who still like to collect. But as I say, a lot of the process of consumption these days is on the borrowing. It's on the library. You have Spotify, you have Netflix, Amazon Prime, whatever. Goodreads or something, you know, for audiobooks. So you don't have that mentality. So how can you assess how well a show is doing with an audience if you've not got those quantifiable markers like you have when you can look at DVD sales, if the DVDs aren't being purchased in the same way as they were before, and yet you're trying to match them to how they did before, but the market has radically changed within, what, 6 years? 6 years we've seen this massive revolution in how we consume media. And I think that's very hard for an industry to get its head around. And also how it funds itself, because it would fund a lot of, you know, those DVD marketing would bring in, you know, as a commercial revenue fund, and that dries up to a certain degree. So where do you go next?
It's interesting that you mentioned the lending thing, because, you know, you're absolutely right. But at the same time, we live in like this kind of crazy world in which we have all this streaming material, and, you know, just pay a few quid or even get it free and it just appears on your TV or on your computer or on your phone or whatever. You are the product, maybe you're paying for it that way. And yet, shopping trip to York last week for Christmas shopping, lovely day out, beautiful day, beautiful, you know, Christmas market thing going on in York. And then we stopped off at the Monk's Cross Shopping Centre on the way home, which isn't really on the way home, but we needed to just get a few clothes for the kids. And walking in Asda, I see a 12-inch vinyl pick finish Doctor Who for like 13, 14, 15 quid. And it's just like the other side of the coin, isn't it? In that we have the lending library ethos of media, and yet we're still wanting the physical stuff, and we're paying ridiculous prices for the physical contact with the product.
But it'd be interesting to know what age group are buying that.
Yeah, absolutely, which is what I was coming to next. Yeah, so I mean, you know, Doctor Who fans is probably a bit of a spread, but you know, it's laid out there with all the other vinyls of, you know, these new presses of albums that I've already got.
I mean, I'm not for a moment saying that, and I know you're not either, that there isn't still a physicality. That, I mean, people still, or people in their teens and their 20s and their 30s and their 40s don't still like having physical things. They don't like, they will have books on their bookshelf. They will like to have something tangible. It could be, you know, craft fairs are still very big. Props, as we know, are still have an interest. So it's not saying that we've gone totally away from that. But how we consume narrative and what we decide to own, I think, is more selective. So we won't buy, I suspect we wouldn't, a lot of people on that sort of teens to 30s wouldn't buy every episode of a season or buy a box set because they could get that naturally. But if there was something very specific, something that had meaning to them, they might get that. Again, this is not always the case. There will be people within that age group who do buy every Marvel Universe movie, who do buy every Doctor Who season. So I'm not for a moment saying that's all wiped out. But if we think of how, as a people, we would just naturally be all buying DVDs, and before that, we would all be buying videos. That was just the way it was. We'd all be buying albums. Now it sort of becomes a far less of a tangible certain market for distributors that everyone is doing that anymore because everyone doesn't need to.
Yeah.
And the joke is, it's not even like we can now sort of be disparaging about it and go, damn Napster, all people, they're not buying anything, they're just stealing it off. They're not. They're legitimately subscribing to these libraries, these archives, and doing it legitimately. Now, okay, that might not be transmitting very well the royalties to the creators, in like the case of Spotify, but it's still a legitimized service. So yeah, but in a sense, I suppose one of the nice things about that is it does mean, unlike you, who does actually get a lot of stuff because you also review a lot of stuff as well, but if you buy something, it does kind of have a little more meaning to it, and it probably sits on your shelf with a little more meaning than when you've just got rows of DVDs.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I was, as I walked in the door earlier, thinking, right, recording a podcast soon, I walked past two Lego models that I built. One's a VW campervan, the other one's a VW Beetle. And then it occurred to me that just a few hours before, I'd actually been writing about Lego. And I think Lego is one thing, obviously you can't download Lego, but then again, you can play Lego video games. And video games is where I'm really going to with this, because, you know, I mentioned Red Dead Redemption earlier on, and I bought the physical version of that. But, you know, like 5 years ago, it was more than 5 years ago now, Steam started doing the whole, basically what Amazon been doing with Kindle and what Napster had been doing with MP3s and what's now been more legitimized, Spotify and similar services and Apple Music. Just selling games, you just buy the software. Over the internet, directly to your computer. And at the time, that sounded absolutely insane, because why would you want to do that? Why wouldn't you want the box? And then you think about it and you go back to sort of those days when you had like a Nintendo or Commodore 64 or Amiga, or in the 16-bit and the 8-bit days, how many crap games did you have to buy to find something great?
And but it's more than
that,
because when we used to own, because you'd think, well, I want the tangible thing, I want to own it.
Yeah.
But owning is a sort of kind of a misplaced conceptual idea, because it's still all ephemeral, isn't it? It's still it doesn't last. It will, you know, I mean, like I've got DVDs of Babylon 5 and I try playing them and some of them don't work anymore.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, I own the box, but there is a degradation to the artifact. So you don't end up owning it. You lose it. So in a sense, you might own something longer through having a Steam account than you might if you actually bought it you might own the box longer, but the actual content can degrade. DVDs do not have a massive shelf life, nor do CDs. They do start to degrade after a time. So in a sense, there's that factor that comes into it too. I mean, I use Steam all the time now. I find lots of cheap deals. I've been enjoying Fallout New Vegas.
All right, yeah.
It's been great, probably in the same way that you, being obviously a little more futuristic than me, have been enjoying Red Dead Redemption too, in the sense that it's that whole sandboxy, not sandboxy, but it is, well, it's kind of sort of world where you just wander around. I mean, so I enjoy the single player, just, you know, just getting drawn into it and just, you know, escapism, that sort of way that single player offers. Yeah, so it is, again, interesting there. Again, we're into a library state where you actually probably you own it in a different way, where you own it in a way that you don't own stuff you see on Netflix, because that can be removed. But you, it is all still stuff you do not have to have at that time on your computer, and you can download it onto another one later. And it's all, which is an incredible thing, again, which you would never considered back in the day, whichever date you're talking about.
Back in the day, say 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think we need to confirm what back in the day these days.
Yeah,
I mean,
probably the days of very, very, very physical media. Yeah, I mean, there was the whole time with LPs, particularly in the 70s and late 60s, where the LP actual album packaging, the cover and anything else that comes in it, that was very closely connected with your experience of listening to the music. And that went through to the 1990s. I remember buying, which just come back out on DVD now, on Blu-ray, Trial of a Time Lord. I remember buying the TARDIS tin, Trial of a Time Lord. I saved up for it for a couple of weeks, bought it, you know, this metal TARDIS tin. They used to use it in Doctor Who magazine for the random questions thing. And you take the lid off and you've got the plastic plastic packaging that you lift out, and you've got your two VHS cassettes in there and the little book. And you flip it over and it's got a little profile of one of the doctors and tells you it's a limited edition, and there's like different versions of the tin, all with a different doctor on, which you've obviously got no chance of buying all of. And you don't really have that kind of connection with things that you buy now, I don't think.
No.
So it's unusual, unless you're willing to pay the premium and say, I know they do this with Doctor Who, they've done this with the Steelbook versions of Doctor Who, haven't they? And they do it with video games, where you can pay like 50 quid for the game, or you can pay 70 quid and buy the game with some extra art or a pack of cards in it, or a slightly different box with the aforementioned or whatever. It's nice to have, but then the convenience of just putting it on is far cheaper.
Yeah. But then this goes back to what we said, that when you have less time, because of such a saturation of material, that need becomes less important because there's other things on your list already that you need to be looking at.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's less. I mean, I had a friend used to go to his bedroom, and it was always filled a bit like what you've been saying, you know, with stuff that's not been watched or even opened because it's just not been time. But he just enjoyed buying the material.
Yeah.
But that would always stress me out. And I think now, again, especially when you're like teens, 20s, 30s, and housing ladders are a lot harder to get onto, and there's a lot more transitory movement as well, with jobs being more displaced too, you think the pressure of having material becomes more difficult.
Yes.
And so having these sort of things being more remote, I mean, my material is massively reduced. I've still got too much. I've still got books, I've still got my old DVDs in. I've removed all the, this will horrify people, I've removed all the casing, thrown them all away, kept the DVDs into one of the pocket wallets, things like that, to try and limit the amount of stuff that I carry around. But I think the sad thing is, apart from a couple of things which I'd like to see again, which aren't available at the moment, I don't really miss any of it. I have a few videos here, DVDs of Doctor Who here. I have some more back at my family's, at my mum's house, but I don't really, there's occasional moments where it's like I'd really like to watch that and I can't. I'd love to rewatch Babylon 5, but I can't, and quite frankly I haven't got time to. So again, you almost, in a sense, that memories start to become quite important, because your memory of watching Babylon 5 becomes the tasty thing rather than the revisit. like I used to do when I used to work. I used to have it on in the background, but now I can't. In the moment, I've got Shameless running in the background on Netflix. It's a very different world. I think it's a very interesting world to be talking about, as you say, because it doesn't just tie into Doctor Who. It ties into industry, it ties into audiences, it ties into how we consume, and ties into what we value as well, doesn't it? In the sense that, in a sense, it's almost like cinema becomes like the event thing, doesn't it? You go to the cinema to see something because it's something special you want to see because it's an event, not because, well, not for everyone, but for a lot of us don't go just to see anything. We'll go because something particularly special, and it's that thing to see, that thing on the big screen, which is a different experience. And it's almost like that with what we will buy, the things that we will purchase physically are probably things which will mean more than if it would have been any other time, and they become almost like the event in themselves, those minor things that we enjoyed, we did a lot at the time but probably didn't think so much of opening up and having something physical in front of us. It might not last, it doesn't matter so much because there's so many things to be consuming in physical or intangible ways. But I mean, I've not bought a Doctor Who DVD in years now. Certainly nothing of the new stuff, and because I've never felt the need to, because the new stuff's all on Netflix, bar the Whittaker season, which will soon be on Netflix anyway, probably anyway. So, well, unless they keep it as a part of their BBC digital online material. But yeah, it's a funny world that's nice to talk about and try and work out where we are to where we were. And how that affects things like selling books and selling DVDs and how they sell them and how you market special stuff, like you say, the Big Finish or the DVDs with, you know, special covers, or that are marketed to people with a little bit of extra cash who are after something in particular. And that's the people you aim for, and how that has become an even more select market than it was, like you said, 20 years ago with the boxes and the tins and the different covers. It makes it very hard to predict where it's all going to go.
Yeah, it does. It's probably best not to try and predict. I find predictions always make you look foolish.
I mean, I do wonder whether it'll come to a point where there might be a point where a lot of people go, I can't, consuming is too stressful, I can't do it anymore. I am just going to go back to rewatching what I have, because I can't deal with the pressure of the thousand things I need to watch.
Yeah.
I just can't do it. And that's upsetting me. So I am actually going to sit and rewatch Babylon 5 or rewatch Doctor Who or rewatch whatever, and just sit and enjoy the present of knowing there's boundaries to what I have to consume. And so it doesn't stress me out so much.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I did think a few days ago about actually making a list of things that we were planning to watch, and I thought, actually, probably that's not a great idea, because the
no,
list is probably
exactly.
going to end up far longer than what I've got in my head right now. I'll have a conversation with Kerry. It'll be like 3 or 4 times the length, and this is probably going to just like depress the hell out of us.
And after a week, there could be more things on it. So
exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's not wise. Actually, we've just done a really weird thing.
What's that?
Well, we're recording this, dear listener, on December the 2nd. So yesterday we put a tree up. Now, it turns out that the tree was about, I don't know, a foot, maybe 18 inches wider than the space that we had for it, which meant we had to completely reorganize our living room. And what we've actually done, we've ended up turning the sofa away from the TV, which is on a fixed position on a wall, on a kind of pivoting arm, which means I can kind of recline it away if we're not watching it or whatever. And now we can't even, I mean, you can see the TV from the sofa if you sit in a particular position. It's not uncomfortable, but it's a completely unnatural way of watching the TV. And I'm thinking we're actually not going to be watching that much TV over the next month. So, But for this time of year, it's particularly unusual. I mean, I don't regret it at all, because the tree is absolutely stunning. I mean, it's a fake tree. I don't know why I call it a fake tree. Obviously, it hasn't been grown. It's a manufactured tree. It's a really, really nice manufactured tree, which is going to do us a few years. But that whole idea of just moving everything away from the TV is unheard of. In my family, anyway, there's always been a TV in the main room, and now we've got a TV in the main room, and, you know, you can only watch it if you move a table and chair, no, move a chair from the table and go and sit in front of it or whatever. It's quite strange.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's interesting how it changes all these habits. And, you know, going back to Doctor Who, as we said before, you know, where does Doctor Who sit anymore? You know, family material still exists, but it exists on the broad spectrum, broader than anything before, and that is in event cinema, isn't it? The Marvel Universe is the family television, yeah, effectively. Yeah. That is where families will go out either together or separately, but then converse over it by going to the cinema and seeing them in installments in there. And is that the place for something for Doctor Who, which requires a certain amount of pizzazz, spectacle and scale to it in a way that it is hard, but not impossible these days, given some of the high quality science fiction that is out there on these streamers, Altered Carbon, The Expanse. There's some really brilliant sci-fi shows out there that do great stuff, but does it need to be on a bigger scale to with a global market to make it viable in the way that it touches that sort of core demographic? Or does it, as we said before, have to decide on its demographic and focus specifically on that?
Well, following last week's podcast, regular listener Tariq Latif dropped us a line on Twitter. Tariq Latif says, "Really enjoyed the pod. My opinion, and it isn't a popular one, I'm not overly keen on the idea, but I believe it's necessary, is to make Doctor Who a fully serialized show, 10 or so eps with one continuing story, cliffhanger at the end of each ep. It's what people want / expect nowadays."
Again, that depends on where you're marketing it to, doesn't it? I mean, if you're doing it on a subscription, then yeah, that's kind of arguably something you do. On broadcast television, maybe. I mean, I suppose Line of Duty does that.
Yeah.
There are dramas which do, and Line of Duty very specifically makes an effort to do the cliffhanger, and even sets up the same sort of musical, almost like musical sting that sort of kicks in just often when they're moving to the end moment to let the audience know that they're about to punch to a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, there is definitely truth to that. But I don't know. I mean, maybe, well, as we've said many times before over the years, it'd be a different thing to do. So, you know, why not try it?
I think
it depends on how they did it. I think there's so many ways you could do an episodic
approach. Yes.
I mean, do you do it where it's all set in the same setting, as we've said before, like a sort of unit approach, and actually have them all all set within the same sphere, the same issues, maybe different issues, but within the same same sort of geography? Or is it something which sort of is interconnected, which takes them down a sort of long epic trip across time and the galaxy, whatever's, and does that happen as sort of like singular episodes which are episodically tied together? A bit like the two-part opener of the last season? Or is it something more interconnected? Or is it just like a really flowing thing, sort of like, you know, The Expanse or something like that, which is, I don't know. I don't know. It could be quite interesting to see something done like that. You know, a massively long, I imagine that's harder to write, maybe. But then do we need it, you know, would it be better to sort of, like, as we've said before, split it into like two or three events a year and have like three parters which tell a story?
Yeah,
that'd be like 9 episodes, but say, you know, one in New Year, one at Easter, and one in the autumn, and then a Christmas special. You know, you could do a 10 series like that. It depends. I think it depends on whether it's hard, isn't it?
It is.
Because they've done three-parters before and they've never been mind-blowing. How many three-parters Utopia.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the last part of that serial, but I think overall it's good.
I mean, that's an example of a three-parter which sort of takes you on a fragmented journey. So it's not got much flow to it. The last two more so than the first bit. But that's arguably one example. I don't know where the show should be going, to be honest. I know we've had lots of suggestions over the years, but I can't work out what is the sort of fatigue of a show which has been going since 2005 inherently becomes more predictable. And so that's hard to see where it's going stale or where it's just your overexposure and where would be good for it to shift. I think, again, it depends on its model, doesn't it? And if it ended up deciding to end up going and being sort of farmed out to streamers, then, you know, a 10-part, 12-part story might be something that would be worth thinking about.
Yeah.
But how does that fit in the context of Doctor Who?
Generally speaking, I think there's probably three choices, and one of them is to, like, co-production or, you know, push out towards Netflix, Amazon, take that approach. There's the movie approach, and there's the keep on doing whatever the BBC feels like doing with it approach to fill up that gap on a Saturday or Sunday evening, or wherever it feels it needs to put it out, in order to make whatever merchandise money that Doctor Who makes. But when it's not, and obviously the audience figures don't entirely back this up, but the kind of the buzz around the show is definitely not what it was. So there's definitely, and you know, the lack of merchandise and the reduced merchandise opportunities with the last series, and presumably they're not going to be hugely bigger with this one, besides monster figures and what have you. You know, it just, compared to 10 years ago, it feels muted, and in a already crowded, in, you know, ever crowded marketplace for eyeballs and experiences and getting people excited about things, it doesn't feel like it's doing the right thing at the moment, perhaps. Mm. So, you know, not all we can do is sit and talk about it. But my preference would be for a kind of semi-reset, retool, and go down the movie route, I think. And if not that, then a, you know, like a box set experience. I don't think what it's doing now is the right thing on TV. I would like it to be, and, you know, there's no reason why it shouldn't be. Russell T. Davies got it right 15-odd years ago by retooling the show as a, you know, Saturday night show, and everyone said, well, there's no more family TV anymore. And there clearly was. So I'm not saying it's not possible to do it. It's anticipating what's coming next, isn't it? That's what it is. And if you can do that, then great. If not, then maybe take a route that is working elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I feel for Doctor Who, there's a feeling that it's coming to a point now where they're having to make those decisions, and I still don't think that's necessarily to do with quality or questions of choices or even tone or even story. I think it's just simply a lot of it is pressures on it, on what it should be doing now, and at the moment it's still doing what it was doing in 2005, more or less. Last season there were slight changes to the style of the tone and the pace and the content to some degree, but ultimately it's still doing the same thing. And that's the question. Is that the right thing?
Yeah. A question that we've asked before on the Casterbus podcast with again, I dare say we will ask it again.
Well, I think it's becoming more and more of a question, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure we talked about it around about the time they did the, split seasons and the season off, as you said, turning back to your original point. But that was such a different time to where we are now. It's almost fascinating to think how that's, as you said, how different it is and why it needs to change has changed.
Let us know what you think, dear listener. Messages on Twitter, or leave a note on Facebook after you've listened to the show. You wouldn't leave us a note before you've listened. That'd be daft, wouldn't it? We'll be back next week, perhaps, with another podcast with a K. Until then, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbus.com.